Good morning. Senator George is back in the saddle, somewhat.
Somewhat.
Senator Monroe, I know, is up in his office watching. He's not feeling very well at all, and so we're fighting through all these illnesses. And
no, Elvis.
I'm really shaking. I just about passed out in the morning committee.
Well, then let's...
We'll hang on to you. Of course, you know, that's one unstable holding another unstable.
Well, let's just... Then we'll... You should go home.
I'm excused the rest of the day. So yeah, whatever you need my vote for, let's do
it. I don't even know we... Okay, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 181. Mazin, I know we have one amendment. This is the whole issue, and... Do you want to come up? And I'm sorry, I'm just blanking. Cheryl Pellegrini from the Department of Justice and Director Harshenko and our state police, just to refresh the committee very briefly on the good work that y'all do and how thankful we are and the amendment we're looking at today. And Mazin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have worked this bill a couple of times on February 13. Wow, that's almost a month ago. But considering February is 28th date, shall I go about this? Probably not. March 7th. Senator Moreau, I feel with you. I'm sick too, but the amendment that was suggested was an extension of the sunset date. The Dash 1 amendment basically accomplished that, but then when we got back together on March the 7th, we were talking about a different type of amendment which basically extends the sunset date, and this one did in the Dash 2, extended it to 2016, and then injects a reporting requirement in the 2009-2011, so it's the 2011 legislative session where the reporting requirement will come. The Legislative Council was hesitant or advised us that we can't have a language that in any way will actually obligate future legislature to do of an extension of what type of an extension at what time. So the thing that I was able to come up with that basically will carry the intent of the committee and the legislature to the future legislatures was to have, as we have in the Dash 3 amendment, a policy statement. The policy statement looks at the future saying that it is favorable for the legislature to have this task force that is continuously sunsetted at least 8 years in the future. So the Dash 3 amendment includes in its first segment that policy statement that makes it explicit where the intent is, where the policy is. And then Section 5 extended by 8 years to 2016. And then Section 6 would be the one that says when they come and report, and at that time, of course, if the policy statement is taken to what it says, it will be extended again another 4 years.
Great. Okay, so the Dash 3 is the one that we're looking at with the 10-year sunset, and then...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it's 8 years that we... And I somehow heard 8 years and not 10.
8 year sunsets. Good morning. Anything that you want to add? I recall very impressed with the work of the task force, and in my conversations with y'all needed some level of breathing room just to recruit and retain and have that long period of time. Hopefully 8 years does it. To give you that long breadth of time to recruit people and retain them and let them know that the legislature is committed to this task force.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the record. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. 10 years would have been nice. 8 years, I think, will get us where we need to go, particularly with that midpoint reporting requirement. And as I understand it, it would give that assembly the ability to extend out further the sunset so that we're always maybe looking 8 years into the future. Having that sort of time in front of us certainly would allay a lot of the current concerns we have about being able to recruit and retain good professional staff for the task force. So thank you very much. Thank you all.
You bet. And questions for this panel?
Are we in a work session, Mr. Chair?
We are in a work session.
Would you like a motion?
The dash, yes, please.
I'd move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 181.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 181. Discussion. Any objections to that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'd move Senate Bill 181 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr's moved Senate Bill 181 to the Committee on Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate all your work and really the fine work that y'all are doing.
Thank you very much.
Let's do 460. Senator Rowe, we're not going to move 460, so you are free to get well. So open a work session on 460 just to get the committee updated. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 460. We have a technical issue and then a constitutional issue. I can speak to the constitutional issue. So we'll put this up one more time. My understanding, it does not have the votes as of now on the Senate floor, so perhaps we'll come back to it one more time to see if it passes the constitutional issue, and then Steve can speak to the technical issue.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 460 deals with the unused value of gift cards. If there's unused value on the card after 3 years, it would become abandoned property and treated as such. And the amount of the unused value then would go to the Department of State Lands and become part of the abandoned property within the Common School Fund. It defines what a gift card is as a pre-funded value electronically stored for the purchase of goods and services. It would prohibit issuing cards with expiration dates or fees, and it also would exclude phone cards and prepaid committee mobile radio services, and would take effect for cards issued after January 1, 2008. At the last meeting, you had, I believe, four different amendments, and at the end of the meeting, it was basically decided that it would probably be a good idea to combine those into one set of amendments for today. The dash one was considered not needed because of the language in the dash four. So you have the dash six before you today for Senate Bill 460. In the process of combining the proposed amendments, council found a glitch in the language, and it needs some clarification. There's in line 7 of the dash 6 amendment where it has language, if the last known address of the owner of a gift card is unknown. The issue is basically, if it's known, how can it be unknown? So we're discussing and have some proposed language to take to council to see if they would prefer it over what's currently there.
I thought it was me because I was sick.
Last known. That'd be good. That would have been a good one there.
So it slipped by me and a few other people in the process.
Last known address. Any questions for Steve? On the dash sixes. Oscar, would you like to have something on the record, please?
Thank you. Thanks, Chair, decorated members of the committee. My name's Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate for OSPIRG, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. We're a statewide, nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy organization. And wanted to just testify today in support of Senate Bill 460. This bill does provide some much-needed consumer protections regarding gift cards, which is a growing area of concern. As you know, and I'm sure you've heard, millions of Americans are buying gift cards, but find that sometimes unexpected fees or very tight expiration dates really drain the value from what was intended as a nice gift. Gift cards sold by some restaurants, retailers, some banks and others come with dormancy fees that basically penalize the recipient of the card if the card is unused for some period of time. And other cards expire as early as 6 months after they're issued. And the concern here is we really want to be able to make sure that when a consumer buys a gift card, that he can be able to expect that fees, expiration dates aren't going to make his gift literally worthless in a short period of time. And this is a growing sector in the market. In 2006, Americans spent an estimated $80 billion on gift cards, and that's up from about $40 billion just a couple of years ago. So it's a real growing area. What's more, Tower Group, a group that's been tracking this growth, is estimating, I think pretty conservative estimates, that about 10% or in 2006, $8 billion go unredeemed in terms of the gift card value. Senate Bill 460 would add some good protections to this, both prohibiting the expiration dates, prohibiting the fees on gift cards, and making sure that consumers can actually get the value of that gift for them, and do that basically by considering the unused gift cards after 3 years as unclaimed property, housing that value with the state, giving the consumer a place where they can always go and actually get the value back on that card, and then in the process allowing the value of that to be invested and the proceeds from those investments to benefit the common good through the common school fund. So just wanted to weigh in, express our support for these needed consumer protections, think that this will help consumers get their money's worth for cards they actually have put down money for and purchased, and would urge this committee to pass this bill.
Thank you. Thanks for any questions for Ms. Etherington? Etherington, I'm sorry. Thank you, Ms. Etherington.
Great.
Appreciate it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 460. Senator Morissette, I don't know if he's in Bill 37, so we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 37, and Senator Morissette, if you're in the building, we are too.
Senator Morissette was sitting outside earlier, and I think he went to testify.
So, Mazin, you can introduce, and we'll get started. And
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 37 started before it started this session. It started in previous session, last session to be exact. At that time, it had a different name and number. It was Senate Bill 778, and this session it's either Senate Bill 37 or House Bill 2409, and it has came to the Revenue Committee after passing the Committee on Health and Human Services, and after the if it leaves the Revenue Committee, it will go to the Joint Ways and Means. Now, Senate Bill 37, what it does, it takes certain amounts of money that otherwise would go to the general fund out of the cigarette tax, and funds the rural health programs. It funds three distinct programs at different percentages. So the policy decision
that you is in front of you is how we divide the revenues that comes from the cigarette tax. And just to give you a refresher on how cigarette tax work, cigarette tax are defined or divided in two different segments, the 58-cent segment and the 60-cent segment, and they both add up to, of course, $118. The 58-cent segment came with Measure 44 of 1996. And how it works is it divides those amounts, approximately about 20 cents to the general fund, or 37.9, 46 to Oregon Health Plan, and then 0.17 for tobacco reduction accounts, and 10.35 to locals, locals being city, county, and transit for the elderly and the disabled. At equal segments. In the beginning, each of those uses got about 2 cents out of that 58 cents. Then, when Measure 20 came in the year 2002, increased cigarette taxes by another 60 cents. However, at that time, it was the will of the voters to dedicate most of that money to the Oregon Health Plan. However, because of the impact that any increase in cigarette tax has on the previous uses of the cigarette tax, some of the money ended up compensating cities, counties, and locals, basically, and the tobacco reduction account for the amounts that they would have otherwise lost. So we ended up with 97.9 or 98% of the 60 cents going to the Oregon Health Plan, and the rest, the 2%, going for compensation of the other funds. So if we today look at this total $1.18, if you will, and look at the different uses of it, we will find 22.7% going to the general fund, 69.1% going to the health plan, 3.1% going to the tobacco use reduction account, and 5.1 going to local government. That is not inclusive, or it does not talk about the other tobacco taxes. The other tobacco taxes has primarily three uses: the general fund, the health plan, and the tobacco reduction account. It doesn't go to cities and counties. Now, what does this bill do? It takes about, in total, about 3.5% of what starts as the general fund amount and sends it to these different rural health programs at the level of 0.7% to rural health account, rural health safety net at 0.85%, and rural health grants at 2.0%. And you have in the revenue impact statement that I've included in your packet how these different amounts come out of the general fund portion. If you add them all up to the 3.5%, you will be looking at about 3.4 million in the 07-09 biennium and about 3.5 in the 09-11 biennium. Now, having said all of that, you probably are more than aware about the tobacco tax legislation increase that is going with 2201. Some of the amendments to 2201 that are today being looked at with in the Ways and Means Committee does include this bill as part of the amendments that might make it into that big package of the Healthy Kids Initiative, if that goes on. If it doesn't, of course, that's a different story. That's all I know about this.
Great, thank you. Yes. Yeah, Senator Cruz and Senator Morissette, they found you. We have a note here that says Senator Morissette is somewhere in the building, but no one knows where.
Right next door. Right under your nose.
Oh.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
Senator Bill Morissette, mm-hmm. Senate District 6, including the rural parts of Lane and Linn County. Thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 37. I'll be brief. We have other experts here to testify, including my friend, Senator Cruz. This is a bipartisan effort to bring needed health care to rural Oregon, to fill the gaps that have deteriorated, so to speak. The hospitals were Hilburton hospitals. They are inadequate. We don't have enough EMT training. They have to pay for it. This bill would take care of some of that. Safety net clinics, which are the basis for health care delivery systems, particularly in rural Oregon, would benefit from our efforts. And a very important part of this is an economic development issue, and I've been talking to the governor's office about this. We're also looking at lottery money, perhaps, and the governor's office has expressed an interest. I don't believe a company would seriously consider settling in an area that has inadequate health care. I don't believe they would want to move their family to that area. I don't think that they would sacrifice a whole lot to be in a place, even though it's very beautiful. There are a lot of amenities to John Day, for instance, and some of the other small communities, but health care is extremely important. And so I consider this an economic development bill as well as a fix for deteriorating medical services. So with that, I will turn it over to my friend, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, Senator Deckett, members of the committee. Senator Morissette and I have been strong advocates for rural health care for a decade, a decade at this point in time. And it really hasn't mattered who had the majority or who had the chair. We've been on the same page with this. And this is not a partisan issue in any way, shape, or form. But the fact is that some of the more remote parts of the state of Oregon have some significant issues that they're having to deal with. I mean, for example, in places in eastern Oregon, a rural ambulance service may have to cover 1,000 square miles. And you get to some of the small rural health clinics, the service is absolutely necessary and needed because it may be the only health care for a couple hundred miles. Volume is low as far as the business they do. Many of them are not qualified for federal funds, and so this money would actually help them remain viable. And getting back to the rural ambulance, some EMT services are first line health care. I don't know how many years ago when we took our tour of rural Oregon for health care, and we were at Granite, which is not quite at the end of the world, but I think you can see it from there. And their ambulance service was the only health care they had for miles and miles and miles. And they financed that service with bake sales. Some of these small hospitals don't have the ability or even if they could get a tax base, the tax base would be so small that it's to be insignificant. We are not asking for a lot of money here, percentage-wise, out of the funds that are currently available. And when you look at the intent of the master settlement, for example, was supposed to go to health care, and it didn't. We spent it on everything under the sun except health care. So this is a fairness issue at this point in time, because we could have funded a lot of health care out of that master settlement agreement, and we didn't do it. So this would allow a small percentage of the cigarette tax to go to make sure that the health care in rural Oregon remains viable. Senator Morissette talked about it being
potentially an issue of economic development, but I would also maintain it's an issue of making sure that the Oregonians who are currently living and working there have at least minimal access to health care, and really that's all we're talking about. If you've ever been to some of these small rural hospitals, the way they've had to modify their business over time, there'll be half of it will still be a hospital, mostly an ER, and the other half will be a nursing home. It's the only way they can stay in business. So, you know, the ability to keep physicians in these places and to keep the places from falling down is critical at this point in time. It's been critical for a long time. We've ignored it. We've been attempting this for how many sessions now? About three, I think. And I think it's time. I think it's just time. This isn't new money. It's
four sessions?
Okay, four sessions. This isn't new money. This is just a reallocation of a very small percentage of an existing fund. There are others that can speak to the details of it, as Senator Morissette said. But it's time, and it's something we need to do. And I urge your support of Senate Bill 37. And we'd answer any questions, but there are smart people to answer those. So.
Well, on health care, you're our expert, so any questions for Senator Cruz or Senator Morissette? Senator Starr.
Thank you, and if you'd like, you can defer to the other folks, but just this bill put together about $2 million in rural health grants. That's 2% of the total. Who is control? I mean, who administers the program? Who's in it? You know, if you're, I run a rural whatever health something or another, trying to nickel and dime the thing together, and I write a grant proposal. Who do I send it to, and who makes the decision? Yeah.
Okay, it's Senator Deckard, Senator Starr, it'd be through the Office of Rural Health, and they can speak to the. To the mechanism of how this would happen, but it would be through the Office of Rural Health at OHSU.
May I address that, please? Mr. Chair and Senator Starr. The grant program was established after the 01 trip that we took, and Senator Cruz established that program. I don't think the program has ever had money.
No.
I went to a conference, as we both do, from NCSL that next year, and heard from a senator from West Virginia who was a recipient. The southern states were recipients of a large fund of money in the mid-90s to establish grant programs for rural health care. It was very, very successful. It was a community building activity centered around health care, but it now my vision is that once we establish the grant, even with a relatively small amount of money, we then start looking for foundation assistance. And the foundations are not going to give the first money to our grant program. We have to give the first money. So that money, they're viability grants, and the money would be available for EMT training, for some capital investment, and a variety of things that a community needs. For their health, but it has a building effect and will bring in, I'm sure will bring in some foundation money. So this is a very, very important program, and I don't think it's ever had any money in it, has it?
No, well, historically, and clearly this isn't as much money as we'd like, but it's a start. If you go back to the beginning when we established this, we were looking at MUPL money. Those of you who remember the MUPL money, and we were, in fact, we had an agreement. We thought at that point in time to, I think, put $7.5 million of the MUPL money into it. Everybody agreed to it, and then the session ended, and the money disappeared. So, so I mean, that was an agreement the legislature had made. So this is, we've continued to revisit it, trying to get some seed money in this thing to get it going. And that's, you know, why we're here. I wish we were asking for more, but we're trying to be prudent and at least get this thing kick-started. So.
Thank
you.
Other questions?
Thank you.
You've been working a long time. Hopefully this is your session.
This is the time we do it. That would be great.
To bring,
put some
money
in your
account. Thank
you very much.
Mr. Patterson, Mr. Ekblad, Ms. Easton.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Rural Health Association. The Oregon Rural Health Association is a volunteer group, and we work hand-in-hand with the Office of Rural Health and Scottish from the Office of Rural Health. The volunteer group that I represent has 750 individual members. Most of them are rural health providers. They're doctors, they're dentists, they're nurses, and other supporters of rural health. And we have about 50 organizational members that help support the association. Those represented by the organizations are rural hospitals, rural clinics, and other types of organizations that want to be supportive of rural health. As the two senators indicated, we've been working on this program for quite a while. The three main portions of the bill, Senate Bill 37, have all been funded in the past, but the money has never really developed because it may be there, like for their EMS program, was there for 4 years. It was funded from the criminal fines and assessment monies, and then somebody along the way decided that they needed more judges, and the money disappeared for the EMS programs. The rural health clinics had about $3 million a few sessions ago, and the last week of the session, a couple of sessions ago, that money went away to somebody else's priority. Senator Cruz mentioned the MUPL money. The MUPL money, at one time, there was a large amount of dollars coming to the state from a lawsuit, and there was $15 million allocated to the Rural Health Viability Program, and that actually passed and was adopted by the legislature, but it was never released and went to DAS, and they never saw any of the money. So all these programs, standing alone, have been priorities over the years. So what we're trying to do with Senate Bill 37 is put together a sustainable rural health program so that it's not put together with piecemeal, but has a single source of funding. The policy statement is clearly outlined in Senate Bill 37. We took the bill from last session and actually duplicated that, and that's what the interim committee adopted. And as you'll see in the bill, the tobacco funds are allocated on a percentage of the cigarette tax alone. We'd use the same percentages. On the back side of my testimony, you can see the Legislative Revenue Office distribution of those funds and what the bill does. I just draw your attention to the fourth and fifth box there. The third one, it shows the distribution for Senate Bill 37 to be about $8.2 million per year, which represents 3.1% of the total tobacco funds that are available to the state. And the last square, Senate Bill 37, which is the rural health piece, represents all of the funds that are predicted to come into the state for the 07-08 fiscal year and the 08-09 fiscal year. And using the agreement monies also, there's about $355 million that will be coming to the state in each of the next two fiscal years. Of that, we would allocate 2.3% in Senate Bill 37 of the total tobacco resources that come to the state. And we do not believe that, while there may be other sources of revenue, we're not locked into this, but we think that tobacco funds are legitimate to use for health care, and we think 2.3% of the total funds coming to the state dedicated to the 60% of the geographical size of the state is not excessive. So that's the way the funds would be recommended in this bill, unless the powers that be decide to change the allocations or change the source, then we certainly would agree upon that. But I think the key thing is to design a legislatively supportable program to maintain the stability of the rural health resources that we do have.
Thank you, Senator Deckert, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. I believe that passage of this bill would patch some of the gaping holes in the safety net of health care that exists in rural Oregon, and there truly are some gaping holes. The bill assigns three principal duties to the Office of Rural Health. The first one would be to focus on pre-hospital care. Funding would be restored for a program that proved to be very successful from 1999 through 2003, the Emergency Medical Services Enhancement Account. The ORS that authorized the program is 442.507. ORS 353.450 contains the legislation authorizing a companion grant program, and the two together provides grant opportunities for rural EMS agencies. The portion of the fund that our office administered was for equipment grants for rural agencies. The other portion of the funds went to the Area Health Education Centers program, which gave grants for education and training of rural EMS personnel. During the 4 years of the operation of that program, the Office of Rural Health received 354 applications for funding from 134 communities for a request totaling almost $6 million. We were able to fund only 20% of those requests, or $1.2 million. And just examples of some of the things that those grants paid for. We paid for all or part of 12 ambulances or rescue vehicles, 79 defibrillators, 3 ventilators, 107 radios, 103 pagers, 10 jaws of life, extrication tools, repairs, insurance, and maintenance for rescue vehicles, and even basics such as the pads that you need to use on a defibrillator. I even recall one application where we paid for the mandatory vaccinations that were required for the EMS personnel to perform their duties. We believe that these funds actually saved lives in rural Oregon, not only for the people who live and work there, but also for others who travel rural Oregon roads for recreational purposes. A report published in 2005 by the Road Information Project out of Washington, D.C. concludes that traffic fatalities are occurring on the nation's non-interstate rural roads at a rate approximately 2.5 times higher than all other roads. In Oregon, according to that report, there were 2.74 fatalities per 100 million miles of travel on rural roads compared to 0.72 on all other routes, and that's a difference of more than 380%. As you know, there's no state-supported system that guarantees EMS services in all parts of our state, and communities are expected to create and maintain their own EMS infrastructure. And too many of our rural communities must rely on volunteerism and literally, as was mentioned earlier, bake sales and spaghetti feeds just to keep an ambulance up and running and able to respond to a 911 call. Oregon's rural communities need help if we expect them to be trained and equipped to respond to emergencies. The second part of Senate Bill 37 deals with primary care and addresses Oregon's federally certified rural health clinics. Our office's field staff conducted an on-site survey of all rural health clinics in 2004, and I'll give you a couple highlights. The average rural health clinic at that time saw 3,381 visits in a year. Their average operating margin was a negative 13.8%, and 70% reported a negative operating margin, 35% reported a negative overall margin. And again, as was mentioned earlier, many of these clinics are in areas that are so remote and so sparsely populated that even if every person who lived in that community went to that clinic for their health care services, they could not survive on patient revenue alone, yet at the same time, they're the only source of care in a lot of those areas. Jordan Valley, for example, if people did not have the clinic in Jordan Valley to access for their care, they would have to drive 110 miles to the next source of health care for them. This bill would provide a supplement to the operating expenses of a subset of rural health clinics within the state. We call them isolated rural health facilities. And would also provide for some technical support to those clinics to help them survive the economic disadvantages that they face and make sure that they are operating as efficiently and smoothly as possible. Some of the things that our staff would do for those particular clinics are board trainings, They would help those clinics develop an annual strategic plan. They would provide, they would help the clinics to provide data to us on health service utilization, financial status, implementation of a community-oriented primary care practice, and we would check in with them on an annual basis to make sure that they're doing the things that we expect them to do if they're receiving some public subsidy. The third part of this bill that applies to the Office of Rural Health is the first step toward solving the problem of access to needed capital for rural facilities by providing seed money to the Rural Health Viability Grant Fund, something that was authorized in the 2001 legislature, but as you heard, never received the authorizing or never received the appropriation. 25 of Oregon's rural hospitals have benefited from the federal Medicare Rural Hospital Flexibility Program and become critical access hospitals. And the benefit to being a critical access hospital is that they then receive cost-based reimbursement for both Medicare and Medicaid services. And what I think a lot of the general public doesn't know is that every time a physician or a hospital sees a Medicare patient, a Medicaid patient, they actually receive in reimbursement less than the cost of providing the care. So this is a very important program for these hospitals. They actually get cost-based reimbursement. And this has allowed many of these hospitals to actually go from operating in the red to breaking even, some even slightly operating with a bit of a positive margin. However, they still do not generate enough revenue to accumulate the capital that's required to keep up with the times, let's say. Many of these hospitals were built with funds provided by the Hill-Burton Act of 1956 and are desperately in need of refurbishing, just basic refurbishing, not to mention the advances that have occurred since in information technology and other medical technologies. And the other thing that many people don't realize is that hospitals play a different role in communities than they once did. It used to be that they were all about inpatient care, and so hospitals during that period of time were built with really a focus on hospital beds and inpatient care. And you know, when women went in to deliver babies, they stayed a much longer period of time, and more people are hospitalized for more things. Now the focus of a hospital service really has switched to outpatient care, and so the physical plant doesn't always match the actual services that are provided in a hospital. Hospitals, of course, are not the only rural facilities in need of assistance, and in compliance with the original bill for these programs, House Bill 2515, these grants would also be available for other purposes, including modernization of capital equipment, preservation of access to local health services in rural areas through short-term support of vulnerable healthcare providers, incentives for the development of long-term sustainable approaches to providing improved healthcare services and access to healthcare in rural areas, and collaborative approaches that sustain access to quality healthcare. I believe that Senate Bill 37 represents a modest investment that would return impressive dividends for rural Oregonians. Senator Morissette mentioned the economic development connection, and it is quite true that the healthcare system in a rural community is often the first or second largest employer in that community. Very difficult to have any other sort of community development going on if the backbone of healthcare services is not there and vital. I understand that this committee will hear about a lot of ideas and programs that are wonderful and all, I'm sure, needed, and your challenge is to decide how to pay for them. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to, for your hearing this bill and the opportunity to testify. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Ms. Easton.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. On behalf of Oregon's 57 acute community care hospitals and health systems, we are pleased to lend our support to Senate Bill 37. You have heard the specifics of the bill, so I will summarize our support. 36 of Oregon's hospitals are designated rural. They are the cornerstones of a viable rural health safety net system. This bill would assist in maintaining the availability of health care services in Oregon's rural communities. We appreciate your continuous support of the We appreciate your continuous support in healthcare challenges facing Oregon's rural communities. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panel? The contents of this are also in House Bill 2201. Is that correct?
Yes. It's an amendment. They have not made it yet.
They have not been adopted at this point in 2201, but they are being considered by Ways and Means.
There is another House bill over on the House side that has the exact language in it, too.
It's
37.
That's 37. Okay. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Masson, you wanted to make one clarifying point.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the 11 impact statement that I've given you, you can find it in your packet. Mm-hmm. Those are probably where the numbers would be, unlike what you have seen in the back of the testimony. This is the one that you've seen with a lot of boxes that has a new distribution of $8 million a year. This would be 3.5% of total cigarette tax. As the bill came in the legal language.
Can you repeat that? What you just said? I didn't hear you.
This sheet that accompanied the testimony included at the bottom box here an amount of about $8 million.
Yes.
This $8 million is 3.5% of the total cigarette tax as the $118 per pack. As the bill is legally crafted, it says 3.55 of the general fund segment of the 58 cents, which is a lot smaller segment than the total. That. So this, although I did produce this, this was an attempt to help at that time how much would be 3.5% out of which number.
Mm-hmm.
But as we are looking at the legal language, remember, after we put all things together, the legal language of the general fund becomes about 22.7% of the total tax. This amount, as it is crafted in the legal language, gets to be about 0.7% of what would have been total revenue of cigarettes and other tobacco, which means it's a lot less than 3.55, because that's the way it is drafted. Remember, the 60 cents of Measure 20 is dedicated to the Oregon Health Plan by the measure itself. So I believe what happened is Council felt the obligation that to continue the carrying the will of the people, if you will, with that, and not include the 60 cent as part of the 3.55.
Right.
So that's how it ended up a different amount.
Thank you. So just clarify the different numbers.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have also a question. None of the 3.5% comes out of the local share. Is that correct?
That is correct. It comes all out of the general fund. The way the statutes are written, because of this different times of imposing the cigarette tax, they always continue to be two pieces, the 58 cents and the 60 cents. So every time you're looking at them, you think that you're reading about the distribution of the cigarette tax while you're reading about the 58 cents,
mm-hmm.
not the total tax.
Right.
And that's in that sense, then they go after you give to the locals, city, county, and the elderly and disabled, then you go and give to the general fund. But out of that general fund, you also give 51% to the health plan and the total. So there are several levels of iterations with the distribution of the general fund. And the idea here becomes your policy decision is whether to increase the slices, if you will, of the revenue that comes from that 58 cents. You're not basically not touching the 60 cents with the 58 cents, although you are allocating money from the 118 because you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that good enough?
Are there any other questions for Masson or for this panel? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Closed public hearing on 37. And we will be standing in adjournment till tomorrow at...
Sure?
Yes.
You don't want to move this bill down the Ways and Means?
What they have asked me to do on this, because 2201, they may adopt this, I think, relatively soon as an amendment to 2201, is just hold this bill and see what happens with 2201. What do we have? We have tomorrow we have Senate Bill 38. 39, 416, historic property. They've worked so hard on the historic property. We'll see if they found the golden compromise. Senator Walker's been working really hard on amendments to that bill. We are, and then the following week, we're going to start into the whole capital construction debt conversation for the state Monday and Tuesday of next week, and use the higher ed and community college bill to do that. And did we get a lottery bonding? Have we got a lottery bonding bill yet?
I don't think so. I'll check.
Okay.
We got a lot of bills yesterday.
A lot of bills. We are adjourned till 8:45 Thursday.